Paddy Power and the Football Show, the greatest football partnership since Duff and Heskey.
Now then, welcome back. Miguel Delaney of the London Independent is with us. You're there, Miguel?
I am indeed, yeah.
So this was all done with real precision. Pochettino out last night, 6:30 a.m. in the morning. Jose Mourinho announced. Mourinho, it seems, stayed in the hotel that Spurs have on their training campus overnight. Everything scheduled, done beautifully. Quite often clubs make an absolute hames of how they announce and sack coaches. Spurs haven't done that. The big problem, however, might be the coach they've appointed, that small detail.
Yeah, and even I've seen a lot of discussion from Spurs fans today, and some of the words they're using is they haven't had enough time to mourn, and suddenly they have to adapt to this new father, if you like, that they're not completely sure, new stepfather, they're not completely sure about. But even as regards to timing, there's an interesting thing there. On 10th of October, the Lyon president, Aulas, said that he approached Mourinho and was rejected because Mourinho was lined up for another job. And given the speed of this, it's impossible not to think that this, this may have gone a lot further back than this week or the last week, given that's when it really started to look like Pochettino's going to go.
How many national days of mourning is appropriate for Pochettino is an interesting question. Two, three?
But even just in terms of the reaction, I was looking at the response to Spurs' announcement on social media last night, and it was very rare to see that happen with a manager, basically, for almost every fan to be so down about it, which, maybe hints that they're not quite ready for this.
Do me a favour there. Could you knock off your phone onto silent? Yeah, I know you're incredibly popular and that will keep pinging for the next 20 minutes. Okay, you don't need to show off. That's not even WhatsApp group texts. They're actual real ones, aren't they?
Joe's had his on for the last 3 hours, just hasn't got any, to be fair.
So, Miguel, what do we know? What do we know, in terms of Pochettino's departure and how that all came about? And then we'll get on to the approach to Mourinho and his decision to accept the job. The Pochettino situation there, what do we know, first of all?
So, it has been bubbling for a while.
Yeah.
But I think where tension really started to ratchet up was around the Champions League final, actually, when Pochettino was on what was pretty much a publicity tour. He lost weight. He got those nice new treads for a series of press conferences. And it was almost like he was selling himself. And Spurs were particularly perturbed with a lot of his public lines about how if they win it, he'll leave. This could be his last game. And it wasn't so much that on its own, but that in the context of so many times over the past few years when interest from Manchester United or Real Madrid would be mentioned. And rather than kind of dampen it, Pochettino would almost kind of cryptically play on the situation. And use press conferences almost to, add further fuel to the fire. So Spurs were always a bit, or sorry, Daniel Levy really was always a bit perturbed by that, only for it to really kind of reach ahead in May amid what was poor domestic form, which continued into this season, and there was just a really bad atmosphere around the training ground. Another side to this that kind of links into one of the reasons Mourinho got the job is basically that for the past 2 years, Pochettino has wanted to be completely overhaul this side. Mm. He kind of buys into the Ferguson maxim of a team only has a three-year cycle, but even more importantly, he's a bit like Van Gaal in the sense that he works best with younger, hungrier players who can be moulded and basically be more receptive to instructions and won't argue back as much. Mm. And that's the thing that's happened with the Spurs team. All these players that bit older, that bit wiser, that bit more tired of what is a really overbearing managerial regime. And ultimately, Pochettino, he changed Spurs, he changed mentality, he changed the outlook, but he couldn't change that fundamental of football, really, which is that it's easier to get rid of a manager than it is a raft of players. Because tied to that, then, in his pitch, Mourinho told Levy he has one of the best squads in the league and doesn't need that much surgery, which is music to Levy's ears.
It sure is, yeah, sure. I can imagine. Yeah. After 2 years of Pochettino saying, I need to overhaul this thing. Because some of the briefings have been that Pochettino, quite clearly from 2 years back, wanted to start performing surgery in the squad. That wasn't happening under Daniel Levy. And the briefing of late seems to have been that Pochettino was cutting quite a negative figure around the training ground, that effectively he didn't really want to be there anymore.
Yeah, complete. Well, there's always been that element of him looking away. Mm. And this is one thing. I do have a little bit of sympathy with Levy in this regard. Fundamentally, I think it's almost madness for Spurs to get rid of a manager of this quality. And if football was a normal business that way, you'd allow a manager like that the patience and time to build a new squad in the way Ferguson was allowed as well. I think he has had that effect on Spurs and they've been that good for them. But there was always that sense that he was never fully invested in that way, that this might have always been a stepping stone, despite him talking about how much he wanted to build something big at Spurs, something new, that ultimately he wants to be at Real Madrid. He wants to be seen like a Pep Guardiola-style manager, because he used to always bristle at how, you know, Pep Guardiola's Barcelona were credited with, you know, tactical approaches that he felt he was responsible for in Spain. But this season, it has seemed that he just hasn't been as invested. I mean, some of the players were really perturbed after the League Cup defeat to Colchester United, where rather than take any responsibility for what was ultimately humiliation, he started to go on about agendas in the squad as if that was really relevant to a game against a lower league side. And it was just this kind of ongoing... It felt a little Mourinho-like throughout that period, where every comment was basically about positioning himself to be... So how he would be seen best in the media in that sense, or for any prospective job. But yeah, and like there's been a lot of talk as well about... And it's amazing to say this, given how well everything was 2 years ago, especially when they left the original White Hart Lane in 2017, just how positive everything was around the club. But the word being used is that it's been toxic over the past 2 months. Players have sought to avoid him, and I think they're all just a bit tired of it.
Yeah, that's funny, Miguel, because I mean, I was at that Colchester game, funnily enough, and his tone afterwards was striking in that regard, like the shift. But I'm just wondering, you mentioned the timeline there of Mourinho and the approach from France, and you know, there was clearly something afoot. I mean, is there a sense of when Pochettino truly knew the game was up? At what point was this sprung on him, like in a sense that he really expected it?
Last Wednesday, it seems, so basically a week ago, there was a series of meetings that week in which it was apparently suggested by Levy that Pochettino might consider resigning. That's how bad it got. But of course, Pochettino, I mean, even from Pochettino's perspective, that's given up a lot of severance pay. So that's when it got real. And even at that point, from what I understand, there were discussions about how if Pochettino wants to continue to overhaul his squad, there might have to be sales of players. He doesn't want necessarily to sell. They'll have to raise money in other ways. And I think it was just one of those situations where they were disagreeing on far too much. And from last week, really, this was pretty much inevitable. I have to say, I was surprised at the speed of it last night. I thought, from everything I heard around the club, he would have been given until Saturday against West Ham, because there was a lot of talk about how this was going to be a crunch game and maybe even a decisive game. But yeah, I think it was inevitable. And let's not forget as well, this is a team that actually hasn't won the league in 2 months and has claimed only 25 points out of 24 games going back to February, which is really relegation form over two-thirds of a season. So something was broken between this team and this manager. He knew that, though. But ultimately, Levy didn't want to invest that much. And to be fair to Pochettino in this regard as well, what we've heard today now is that Mourinho's wages are double what Pochettino's were, and that he's going to be heavily backed in the next two windows. And you can feel a little bit of sympathy for Pochettino in that regard, because he's basically seeing everything he's been complaining about from the last few years. And I did see a comment from someone today, someone connected to the club, who was basically saying, so after what, 4 years of prudence from Spurs and behaving like this responsible, diligent club who are very careful with the finances, with Mourinho, are they going to suddenly start behaving like Zenit St. Petersburg and splashing cash around?
It is a strange turnabout. I mean, of all the chairman managerial partnerships you could have thrown at me, it's hard to think of one that has less promise than Mourinho and Daniel Levy. It just will not work. The extent to which they'll give him funds, I'll be fascinated to see. And then, as you said, when he does go off and buy Fellaini, the Spurs fans will rightly think, what's going on here?
Well, three of the names already mentioned, which I think are very relevant to us. I mean, Mourinho, in his pitch to Levy, basically said, over his 11 months out of the game, he's refreshed, he's living in London now. So he's, you know, all this matters, given, you know, how bad things got United, living in the Lowry and all that, but that he's developed a new football strategy, a new philosophy, you know. And to be fair, he has shaken up his backroom staff, which I think is relevant in terms of kind of new voices. But then three of the names he mentioned to Levy are Fernandez of Sporting Lisbon, who Spurs had previously been interested in, Diaz from Benfica. Both of those are Mendes clients, or at least connected to Mendes tangentially, as many players in Portugal are. And then a third name was Nemanja Matic.
Stop. you're joking, Nemanja Matic, are you?
No. I mean, he likes experienced players in that way.
Can't run.
You think you could just throw Gareth Bale or someone into the mix just to get the Spurs fans on board, you know? Something like that.
That's a hell of a new philosophy.
Yeah. But I mean, and this is it. But for all of Mourinho needing to change, some of this might be Levy changing as well.
Are you actually excited, Miguel, to have Jose back on the beat?
Would you stop? This man, like, he just put his kids through college here. He can't wait.
Like, you know,
I have to say, one of my first thoughts last night was basically, oh God, all this again.
And isn't that the strongest argument against Mourinho? Like, I was going to ask you, was he their first choice? But there is the on-field stuff, and that, you know, Manchester United fans will tell you that even the second place finish, but the two sixth place finishes, it is grim, grim football, and they've become accustomed to very good football. So there's the on-field stuff, but there is the scorched earth policy off-field, and this general air of conflict that Mourinho seems to thrive under and is energised by. You look at his treatment of Luke Shaw. You know, it's funny watching Sky Sports News again this morning, and you're reminded of him even when Luke Shaw had a good game, and he's saying, well, he only played well because he, in that half of the match, I was beside him on the touchline, and so I dictated his every action. I talked him through the game. You think of even his last season at United, when Rashford missed a chance, and he turned to the crowd and spread his arms as if to say, what can I do? You know, like, again, like destroying a young player. Martial maybe hasn't thrived necessarily under Solskjaer, but he was ready to turf Martial out of the club completely. I mean, this scorched earth policy that they've signed up for, I just can't understand that, whatever about the on-field stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, just you mentioned Rashford there. When Mourinho made his big pitch to United, which I was looking through my notes last night, and it was very similar to what Spurs got. But one of them was, he's a great fan of Rashford. And we saw how that went. So, I mean, there's a certain amount of lip service here with that. In saying that, I do think he went for the United job a little bit too early. He hadn't had a sufficient break. Whereas I think this is a bit more pronounced. And given United ended as it did, I think maybe there has been a bit more reflection. So I am actually, I mean, one of the things I was thinking in all of this was basically, Mourinho, we've discussed the same old team. Even what we're talking about now, it's the same old teams for so long. But maybe now, I am a little bit intrigued to see, will there actually be something different in how he plays and how he sets up on Saturday? So at least that'll provide something a bit fresher, at least for the first few weeks. But at the same time, given all that, I think there are actually more serious questions to be asked of Spurs and Levy here. Their first choice for this job, in the event of Pochettino leaving, for a long time it was actually Eddie Howe, but obviously that's receded in the past year or so. But up to the last few weeks, it was Brendan Rodgers or Julian Nagelsmann at Red Bull Leipzig. And I'm not, if you're a kind of a prudent club and the way Spurs have been portrayed in the way they're run, I'm not sure how you can have a model of football that can have an ideal choice like Rodgers and Nagelsmann. Again, they go to pretty much the complete opposite in Mourinho. And that does hint at a certain rashness there.
Yeah, there's a parallel there with United as well.
Spurs are meant to be more rational in that regard. In fact, not too long ago, where in ahead of games between United and Spurs, myself included, were all praising Spurs for their modern outlook compared to United's kind of more chaotic back of a fag packet approach.
And so, there's a number of players, not least Eriksen, free to talk to other clubs come January. Any sign of those contracts being put to bed or sorted out? Or, you know, like I guess every player now is talking to their agent and wondering how they feel about playing under Mourinho, and he'll have to be nice as pie over the next couple of weeks. But where are we on those players?
Well, I saw today already from Denmark that Eriksen just doesn't want to stay, no matter, and Mourinho won't be able to persuade him. Because with Eriksen, it was never really a football issue. It was more he wanted to change a lifestyle. He wanted to play in Spain. It's been a dream of his. So I think it's almost impossible for him to stay. Someone like Alderweireld is more interesting. In fact, his his interview on Sky Sports News last night was quite funny in the sense that this wasn't a man devastated at Pochettino going. And of course, let's not forget that he's one of about five or six of this Spurs squad that Mourinho has tried to sign while he was at United, including Danny Rose, who's a contract rebel, including Eric Dyer, who had his own issues with the club, including Harry Kane. And I mean, to give Mourinho some due in that regard, whereas Pochettino was a manager better suited to a younger squad, Mourinho's always idealised pretty much a squad of this age profile, where they're all that bit older and, as you put it, warriors.
Yeah. I mean, could it work?
My gut is still no. I did a piece about 3 weeks ago talking about, and I got a canvas load of coaches for it, including some at Leicester City, Chris Davis, Brendan's assistant, about how like transitions are now the most important thing in football. And he was going into detail about just the level of coordination in top level football now and how much that has evolved in the last few years. And it's almost like, so, like professional football at top level almost have to learn as many moves as, say, top quarterbacks in the NFL. It really has got that detailed. And that is basically light years from what was Mourinho's peak only a decade ago. Like, the game has changed that much in that time. And it always became very apparent in those matches, say, between Liverpool and United, particularly two at Anfield, where, while Klopp was, I mean, at that time he was still building his Liverpool side, but trying to impose a certain game, and United were playing a game where they were lumping the ball to Lukaku with a 50-yard gap between the midfield and the striker. Whether he can change that much in 11 months, I think that's ultimately, we are talking about the fine details here, and the Spurs are a team that have to make up a gap to richer rivals. These are the details that are going to matter. Whatever you say about his personality, about his man management. So that's why I'd be skeptical, I have to say. I still think ultimately he's past his peak.
Yeah, it won't be dull, that's for sure. Miguel, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
The Football Show on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
I'm prepared to anything I can.
Well, do it then. Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Welcome along, Football Show. Dan McDonnell is in studio of the Irish Independent. We have a chat with Stephen Kenny coming your way. Spoke to him earlier on. That will be the bulk of the Football Show this evening. Stephen Kenny, as you'll hear, probably in a tricky position in that everything you want to talk to him about, really honestly and openly, is very difficult for him to talk about because he would be stepping on Mick McCarthy's toes and it wouldn't be appropriate. And he's acutely conscious of not wanting to do that.
Yeah, well, you have when you think about it, you have a very strange situation now. The fact that Ireland's Euros fate isn't resolved until the end of March, and I mentioned this in a piece today in the paper, that like the draw for the next Nations League, because there is another Nations League, is on March the 5th in Holland. So you have a situation where like Stephen Kenny will actually know his Ireland games for the autumn before Mick McCarthy knows if he's still in a job for the summer and what's happening in the summer. And so do you send Stephen Kenny to that event? You know, do you interview Stephen Kenny and go, Stephen, so I don't know, probably Denmark away or someone again, you know, in September or whatever it might be? Or do you ask Mick how he thinks he'd get on? Because can the under-21 manager really be talking about senior games? Definitely, like there's a political aspect to this that sort of makes things reasonably uncomfortable. But I guess there are situations where things could have been more uncomfortable for Stephen Kenny. For example, if the 21s were losing games 4-1, it might be a bit more of a difficult discussion to have with everybody. Whereas when your team is winning 4-1 and people are pretty excited about what's coming down the tracks, you're in a good position.
Well, that's a fair point. So we'll come to the 21s in a second and we'll play the Stephen Kenny interview. Let's start with Monday briefly. Didn't talk to you since Monday.
No.
Go on then.
Yeah, I mean, it's been polarising. Or maybe that's just because I watched Ger and Gary Breen have an argument about it. Monday was good. Like, Monday was probably better than good without being great, you know? I think it is very fair to make the point that, and it was always probably a big plus from the Irish perspective in a strange way, it was touched on. The fact that Denmark only needed a point, that there was probably going to be an element of a seed of doubt with Denmark at some point. And I think that certainly say the amount of possession that Ireland had was probably influenced by as much by Denmark's situation within the group and the game as it was sort of Irish brilliance. Mm. But at the same time, there was a certain amount of encouragement to take from how the team played and performed. And I guess it's an Irish thing again, that you can probably always trust that when it's a chips are down game, with the exception of the 5-1 where things went a bit mad, that there will be a performance. It'll be a, you know, as I said, it wasn't like a performance that made you think, well, this is some kind of awakening, but it was a performance that made you think, you know, these players have performances in them, and come March, they can get through. But then again, you know, it's another goal from a, like, Ireland in the 5 games since the Georgia game at home. I mean, if you can look at it in a very positive way in terms of spirit and courage. But I mean, they haven't scored a goal in the first 80 minutes of any of those games. We didn't score at all against Georgia and Switzerland, and 3 goals in the 85th minute in other matches. You know, all 3 coming having fallen behind. Mm. So to just flip things around to a scenario where you have to go and win matches, and to really, like, to go away, as Ireland will now against Slovakia, and, you know, need to be sort of disciplined enough, but cute enough and intelligent enough to sort of break through and get that intelligent 1-0 away win where you can see it out. Like, we haven't seen that this year. Like, you haven't seen that. Like, I thought Denmark away, they did well, but they still sort of see the control to allow Denmark. And so when you play against a team now that, I guess, you would think the Slovakia are inferior, and you would have thought the Georgia are inferior, as much as they've turned out to be quite decent side, turns out how they played against Switzerland and stuff, do you believe that clinical stroke, that streak is there? I don't think you come away from Monday thinking, oh, we're definitely going to go to Slovakia and do the business now.
Oh, no.
You know, I think that Slovakia are, as in, like, are the home side as invested, and do we have that sort of subtlety to really deliver that away form and then do another one potentially? Like, it could be home and away. Yeah. Like, obviously the draw on Friday, you're hoping that at least there's this prize of a home game in the second leg. I think Ireland at home would beat all those teams in the playoff, but I think obviously believing that you can just go away and sort of get the job done, it's going to be an ask.
So the draw for the final, not to get too presumptuous, yeah, that's for who has home advantage.
Home advantage. Yeah. Unless UEFA for tomorrow decide, hey, we've just decided to give the hosts potential home advantage in the final or something. Like, we'll come back to this depending on whether the draw is 2 aways. I mean, for fans and people involved and people who listen to go to games and stuff, this is it's messing with their heads, you know, because you might be booking flights to a game not knowing if you need to come back from there or not. And it's so anti-supporter, yeah, this process, yeah, that as much as is possible, they probably need to give clarity in advance. But there's no clarity of, like, you know, it could be any one scenario is possible. It could be Bosnia against Slovakia and whatever, you know, that's, and we could be coming back to go to Belfast, which isn't that difficult, you know. So there's a lot. I was encouraged, but, like, I don't know, like, what's your, were you sort of coming away buzzing from the ground, or are you sort of on that sort of halfway house? Like, I just think there's 4.5 months till the next game. So ultimately the bottom line is you can't actually bring the momentum from Monday into March anyway. Yeah. So, like, it was encouraging and there's good signs, and I think it would be remiss not to acknowledge those things. I think it would be unfair to be just completely, I think some takes on Monday have been a bit too much on the negative side, but at the same side, like, we still have these problems with creativity and goal scoring. Going to need to be better in that regard in a away game when you need to, like, you know, pick your chances and take them.
Yeah.
And it's four or five months till the next match. So how do you know it's not going to be Tbilisi again in March?
You take almost no momentum from
it. It's impossible. There's too much that can, yeah, like, you know, changes in people's careers. Like, guys could be in promotional battles, relegation battles, going to change club, injuries. And, like, what we see, definitely, like, McGoldrick's importance, that's been asserted.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if someone like him is unavailable, for example, or Randolph or Shane Duffy, or, you know, you're one step away from crisis pretty quickly. So it's hard to be confident, certainly. I enjoyed it, but it's just hard to be madly confident that the things are going to be okay. It's going to be another standalone
event where you hope that there's performance, but
like in a magical,
there's no discernible pattern.
No, there's no pattern. Well, you're hitting on basically the one point I was going to make, because I've talked about this last night as well, so there's no great
reason to, I get that,
waffle on about this for ages. There is obviously the possibility come March that Troy Parrott and Jose Mourinho is a love affair, and Troy's playing Premier League football and banging in goals. There is the possibility Aaron Connolly has caught fire as well, as in great form. Shawnee Maguire looked good when he came on Monday.
Big week for him, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe he brings that club form and keeps playing well. And suddenly, between those three and McGoldrick, you have some genuine attacking options.
Yeah.
And we might be feeling a bit better about things. Like, it was most certainly the best performance of the campaign, that is without question. To my eye, it was the performance where they looked to try and play the most football in a concerted manner. The Danes did stand off at times, but still there was a real effort on Randolph's part and Duffy and Egan's part and Whelan to try and get us playing. Now, it didn't always result in the most comfortable passages at play.
That's also because of the crowd as well. I think there's a crowd unease with some of it too. Do you not think?
No.
Like, you know...
No, I genuinely...
There was a few jitters from the...
But there was a reason for
like, hang on, we're not really used to this.
There was a reason for the jitters, and that's because we were, I think in fairness, people are used to seeing that style of football, centre-half splitting. The reason for the jitters was, with each moment that Whelan touched the ball, we were moving further and further back, and the centre-halves were moving further and further towards Randolph. And so, yes, at a certain point, get rid came into
it. I get you, but
like, not at the outset.
But like, I mean, we're all very positive about the 21s, and I am positive about the 21s, but yeah. I mean, there was no atmosphere in Tala last night, really small turnout. There's a couple of moments in the first half where Gavin Bazunu was just execution of his pass out weren't quite perfect, and the control wasn't great. And I can just imagine in a full stadium, you know, everyone like, oh, and like, that makes it, that magnifies it. So there is an element of that as well, that like with Stephen Kenny's first game as the Dock manager, I always remind people of this, that they'd been rubbish for years. And then in the first match, Richie Towell came back and took the ball off the keeper. And like, it was like sort of...
they say one man fainted in the crowd.
The crowd just didn't know. It was like they were at a funeral and someone heard knocking in the coffin. Do you know, like people were just like, what the hell is going on here? So this isn't meant to be. And there was a real unease there. And I think there's an element of, if you want Irish teams to play, I think there are people in the crowd who have to accept that this is going to happen.
Well,
too.
Maybe. Look, it was a hell of a night for them to start, but I was certainly pleased that they did start. I suppose, to share your point about a lack of momentum and there's no real pattern to it, like... that is us in games. Because we can't control a ball, we can't control the game. So we are always, as a team, that bit reactive. And generally hard work and bluster and James McLean bursting every lung he has.
Yeah.
It gives a certain competitiveness.
That has a function as well, yeah. You know.
But in terms of us controlling any game, you couldn't still have any faith that Ireland will go out and control any game. So there is just this element of randomness. But I did, in fairness, think it was a good performance. You can't totally disassociate yourself from the sense that Denmark were through at all times and knew they were and played like a team who knew they were. But it was much better, and it would be wrong to just say, oh well, you know, it was same old, or you know.
It wasn't same old. It was a better version of same old.
With
same
some
old.
Quality.
It was a better version of back to basics, and I think that's some people would believe that's maybe the ceiling of what can be achieved.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and you certainly listen to some of the language from people who've played at a really good level, and they just think, yeah, you know, get the opposition turned, you know, and then squeeze up a bit, and that's what you do.
No, our midfield is still a problem. It is. And Glenn Whelan was excellent. But,
like,
I mean,
I just wonder, you know, the knockout game in like, see, because it's a one-off game in March that...
Which we only need to draw.
Not, yeah, to go to penalties, you know, or to extra time penalties. I'm not sure if they've confirmed it's extra time, but, you know, to go to that scenario. Like, it's different than going there thinking a point is a good thing. So are you bold enough? Are you brave enough? And that's where, like, the test of approach and attitude will be.
Yeah. The 21s last night then, 4-1 against Sweden. We're going to play the interview with Stephen Kenny in a couple of moments' time. They were 1-0 down at half-time. It seems he made a bit of a change. And I was in here, I was in the office, and we had a pre-record, so I was able to go out and watch about 25 minutes of the second half. It was almost odd seeing players in green jerseys play like this. This was glorious stuff.
Yeah, it was brilliant. I mean, brilliant. I found the away game in Sweden thrilling.
See, that was the night of the Bulgaria game where Jack Byrne made his debut.
So
we only saw, you know, on kind of dodgy 3G Troy Parrott coming off the bench to score these wonder goals.
Well, a couple of us watched it. We were able to watch the whole game in the press room, and just how they played that night was brilliant. Aaron Connolly was flying. I mean, last night they were pretty, actually, they weren't great in the first half at all.
No.
But they sorted things out. They have changes. And what they have is like attacking players with a bit of versatility. The Parrott went a bit left. But drifted. I know you got Stephen Kenny coming on. So, like, you know, Parrott went a bit left in the second half, but was cutting inside, interchanging with Conor Ronan as a playmaker. Zach Elbazetti on the other side, really athletic. And then you have, like, a number nine, Adam Ida, who leads the line. And, like, it's just a good contrast to skills and talent. And then behind them in his second half was Coventry and Jason Knight from Derby, who I really like as well. Mm-hmm. Like, they're an under 19 team in Parrott's this side, you know. But I love the third goal. I mean, if you want to see how this team's personality, it's the third goal where Leo Connor and Jason Knight win possession at their own corner flag. And Leo Connor plays it out, plays it to Knight. Knight plays it back to the centre half, Collins. And Sweden almost back off a bit as well, because, like, well, this team can play, you know, and you know, three passes later, it's a goal. So, I mean, it is something that it's hard not to get swept up with it. I do make the point, though, again, that when you have, it's a very different ball game to suddenly translate that to the Aviva. Like, some of the stuff in the first half last night was so bad at times that in a full stadium, you can just imagine the jitters, the nerves, and people mightn't recover. But at the same time, like, you also have to trust in these players too. Like, they've spent a fair bit of time together this year, and they understand each other's movements. And you can just see in some of the goals that it's not stuff that's happening by accident coming together. Like, it's not crosses coming into the box.
Yeah, it's the question I was asking. So, you know, you've watched Kenny for a long time, and you've probably seen these players coming through pre-Stephen Kenny. Mm. Are his fingerprints all over that performance?
I think, to be fair, like, some of these players have played extremely well at underage teams, but not always together. And like what Kenny has done, I think, as 21's manager, as he's identified the better players that are coming through of different ages and molded them into a formula that works for him. Okay. Like, generally, you know, a team's underage player have played with the sort of, you know, that version of a sort of 4-3-3, you know, and so, but Kenny has always played that, certainly in recent years, at his clubs as well. Mm. So there is the fingerprints of a Kenny style, but also there's people like Jim Crawford coaching there, who was, you know, who's been part of the underage setup and very well highly thought of, and obviously Keith Andrews is there too. I think there's a bit of everything, and I think there's a bit of everything. You can't just lay it down at one man, but I think, I guess, you know, at 21's level before, we floundered a bit, and I'm not just having to pop people that were there, that the 21s seemed to be isolated from the other underage groups, whereas now it's all flowing together. Mm. You know, it's all flowing together and hopefully flowing into the senior team as well. And I do believe, like, given time, that you will see a Kenny identity on the senior team. But, like, there is going to be different pressures on him, very different pressures. So, like, I think that I'm very excited about what's coming, and my gut feeling is that I'm feeling better about it as time goes on. But also, I think there's an element of occasionally just trying to rein it in a bit too, that it is going to be a very different ball game as well. Mm. And, you know, Sweden last night are a young team. They got demoralised, and they didn't have the cynicism to shut up shop at 2-1 and just, like, kill the game for a few minutes. And, you know, whereas, say, against the savvy senior side who are getting overrun like that, they might have been able to take the sting out of things in a different way. So there's all these caveats to go with it.
Yeah.
But it's a good group. It's a good crop of players. They're missing a lot of players as well. So it's very hard not to think that, you know, there is a good era coming ahead of us.
Okay. A short break, and then we'll be joined by the current under-21 and very soon to be a senior Republic of Ireland manager, Stephen Kenny.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Shearer and Owen.
Now then, welcome back. I'm very happy to say we are joined by the current under-21 and soon to be senior Republic of Ireland manager, Stephen Kenny, is on the line. You're there, Stephen?
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Very well. So the reason we wanted to talk to you, I suppose, in the main was last night at Tallaght Stadium. Half-time wasn't so good. Second half was a joy to watch. I suspect it was one of those performances as the clock ticked towards 90 minutes where you could kind of sit back and really enjoy what you were seeing.
Yeah, it's been a really good 10 days for us, Joe. I think we're delighted to win last night. Sweden had beaten Iceland 5-0, which was a shock, because now Iceland are quite strong, and they'd absolutely hammered them. So they came in to beat Luxembourg 3-0, so they came in good form into the game. And you know, they were deservedly ahead of half time, it must be said, against us. So to turn around in the manner we did, and you know, we scored four terrific goals and created a lot more chances and played really, really well.
Yeah, it was joy to watch, really. I think a lot of people were struck by that, if they were, whether they were watching the full game or even just highlights coming through in social media. Just some brilliant passages of play, and as you said, it could have been more than four.
Yeah, like, I think a lot of the players really stood up, because it's you know, anyone can turn it on when you're sort of well on top in games, but I think we probably lost our two most experienced players at half time. We made two substitutions at half time, and Jason Malumbi as our captain and Connor Masterson probably weren't quite 100% in the game, I didn't feel. They had recently sort of had injuries at the club and come in, and they probably weren't quite right. So we made the decision and they come off. And so we're quite a really young group on. And, you know, I think it's hard to believe, like, Gavin Bazunu, our goalkeeper's only 17. Like, he was so mature last night. Obviously, together him and Troy Parrott are both 17. And Jason Knight, Nathan Collins and Adam Ida are only 18. So, you know, all of those Swedish players are 20 years of age at least. You know, they're legitimate under 21s, 90 and 98s, and they're all playing at a good level in Sweden. The Swedish league is, they're all playing at four teams in Sweden. It's a good level with some of the top clubs there, and some of them are playing abroad as well. And so it was a very, very convincing win, and the players really showed that they could produce it despite losing 1-0, despite things not going very well in the first half. To turn around and play as well as they did speaks volumes about, you know, their attitude and their character.
And why is our batch that bit younger, Stephen? Is that a choice you made consciously, or is it just the way the chips have fallen?
Yeah, there's an element of that, I must say. Sort of, I've consciously made a decision to pick the players with the greatest potential, because it is about development for the future. And I felt the age group is 1998, for example, or 1999, they're the two age groups. But we picked players across five age groups, and we've picked, you know, I suppose it's to the detriment of our under-19s as well. You know, I think Tom Moan did a terrific job doing the 19s. But I think it's likewise, you know, we want our better players to get access to under-21 level football earlier. And hence, if they do well at that level earlier, they get, you know, they're ready for the first team earlier. And that's certainly, they're ready for the same national team earlier. And that's, I've always felt that we've too reluctant to put young players into the senior international team over the last two decades, to be honest. And I think
why is that? Why is that, do you think?
We consider someone 24 young, like, you know, we put a 24-year-old in and we're talking about a young player coming in. And I think, to be fair, it's great to see in recent times Aaron Connolly stepping up, Troy Parris and Leo Connor. And it's probably not, overall, probably not justified under club form, because although Aaron scored two against Spurs and recently got into the Brighton team, but obviously Troy and Lee are not regulars at their clubs, and Aaron's just broke in. But it is good to see that there is a, you know, a progression and opportunity. And, you know, to be fair to Mick McCarthy, he's selected those players in the senior national team.
Yeah.
And I think it's great to see players, you know, progressing and stepping up quickly, because, you know, over the years, you know, you've looked at players like, for example, Seamus Coleman was probably one of the best right-backs in England and didn't go to the Euros at that time. You know, he was considered a young player.
He was 24.
In his 20s, you know. Yeah. So that sort of thing. Even John Egan went for $4 million from Brentford to Sheffield United a few years ago. And at that stage, he was probably ready, you know what I mean, to be playing in the senior national team. So, in my opinion. So I think there is a reluctance to sort of over the years. So, you know, but it must start, there must be a sort of cohesive plan between 15, 16, 17, 18s to promote players younger. you see the under-15s winning convincingly again yesterday. Well, not convincingly yesterday, they beat Poland yesterday, but they've been winning convincingly recently. A lot of players coming through. The under-17s topped their group in that four qualifier to get through. Obviously, the under-19s had got to the semis of the Euros. And, you know, so players are... We must move players up through the ages, you know, quicker. And I think that's not everyone's viewpoint. Everyone doesn't have a viewpoint. A lot of people, some other people would have a viewpoint. Let players play in a natural age group and try and be as strong in each individual age group. But I think it's about getting players to play at the highest level they can as soon as they're ready and not delaying that progress and getting players to excel and exposing them to top-class international players. And we played Italy recently under 21s. Pellegrini is $22 million to Juventus. And Tonali, who starred for the senior team in the last couple of internationals, came down from the senior team to play in the under-21 international. You know, Tonali's a new sort of Italian Pirlo. And he played. And, you know, straight away after they played us, Tonali and Moise Keane were to fly out to the senior international team for that, for the second international. So the players were fluid between the under-21s and the senior team. And certainly... Moise Keane got sent off against us, so he was ruled out and couldn't go. But that gives you an indication of the way they think, you know. And I think that's it really. But a lot of those players last night, they showed that despite having a setback and things not going well, they have the ability to turn that around. It demands a certain amount of fortitude and belief within themselves. And I think when you do that and then you win comprehensively, which it was a really, really comprehensive victory, that, you know, that adds that adds to their confidence levels, and that shows justifies their belief in themselves.
Yes, no, I've no doubt. And like the way you talk there is very exciting, I would say, from an Irish football point of view over the next couple of years. And so that's how you see the game. And even in the midst of what will be in the future, high-pressured World Cup qualification games and all the criticism and the attention and the scrutiny that will come with the role that you're heading into in due course, giving you the chance, promoting players of technical talent, it seems that is the manager you're certainly striving to be anyway.
Yeah, you know, I have to be careful.
I know.
You know, don't be disrespectful in talking about my future role. You know, I think ultimately, I am the under-21 manager, and at the moment, and that's certainly my focus. That has been my focus on since over the last year. You know, and I think between March and November, we've been unprecedented. We've played 12 competitive internationals. Never been a season like that, because we pushed to get into the Toulon tournament. Obviously, Ireland haven't been in it in 15 years, and it was great matches because you're playing against teams from different continents. We played Mexico twice, who are they won the gold medal in the London Olympics, so that they're trying to get to prepare for Tokyo. So you see the quality of the teams like Mexico going to go to Tokyo, Brazil, of course, we played Brazil first time in Irish teams ever played Brazil in competitive action. And we played them in the Toulon tournament, and we played China and Bahrain. So just different cultural experiences, different styles, different tactics, giving the players access to that. And that's helped them, I think, in this group, because when we went to play Italy are probably, I think, in the top two teams in Europe at under-21 level. And when we're going to play Italy, we're saying, like, well, we've already played Brazil. Brazil are the best in the world. So, you know, we're capable of matching Italy. And I think that has helped them, the mindset. And then when you go away to Sweden, you're saying, well, you play Brazil. And, you know, Sweden are nowhere near that. And they are one of the better teams in Europe. But, you know, we've got a lot of talent here. And it's up to us to really go and show what we've got. And I think that was important. Traits.
Yeah. So, look, I certainly appreciate your position here, and it's a almost unique scenario where Mick is doing his job, and you want to be respectful of that and not be on the radio.
I do. Absolutely. Because you know, there's a great opportunity for the seniors' national team now in the playoffs. Well, qualify for the European Championships in Dublin, which would be really special. So
yeah,
you have to respect a little.
No, I think that's absolutely right and fair. Can I ask you then maybe a question which is nibbling around that situation, but which is probably one you're free to answer, I suppose. In the time you've had away from international windows with the 21s, you've obviously had that bit of time to think about things, you know, maybe assess yourself, where you'd like to improve, where where you might want to take advice. I don't know, have you gone to other clubs or academies around Europe and picked the brains of international coaches? Can you give us a sense of how you've been spending your time away from, I appreciate, a busy enough under 21 schedule as you try and get yourself ready? Because I'm sure people would be interested in that, Stephen.
Yeah, that is a myth, of course. Weeks off where you're sort of relaxing on the beach somewhere. No, I think in between matches, we've had a very busy calendar because we've had the 12 games. And it's been a learning curve for me about international football, because the 10-day camps, when you've got two games, too quick for our games, and the travel in the meantime, you've got to detail, like every hour is, every minute really is detailed from when you're in camp to when you finish, and you know the level of concentration, the level of meetings you might have. For example, we'd Armenia and Sweden, for example, so you could have three meetings on Armenia, which would one would be sort of an overview of how they play. The second one would be just to focus on all their individual players. The third meeting might be their set players and for and against, how they defend and how to attack and set players against them to exploit them. And then there might be the focus on your own play as well. So it's very, very intense. Mm. And then the sessions on the pitch, of course, in relation to that, we always try and... There was always squads of 20, only travelled to 21s. We insisted on 22. We always had 22. And then we've brought in sort of home-based players to supplement that for our training, so to make sure that we can always do 11v11. Because previously you might have had a squad of 20 and you had a few injuries and you couldn't work on 11v11. We'd always make sure that we were able to do 11v11 and work on our style of play against whoever we're playing and what our tactical approach to the games, because it does vary, depending on the opposition, of course. And so very, very intense. Those 10 days are very, very intense and travel, and then you've got a quick turnaround, obviously the long trip from Armenia, which is 4 hours the other side of Moscow. So it's a long trip, and then you get back and you've got to prep for Sweden. They're all different tactical challenges. Sweden, one of the few teams left who still play 4-4-2. So they're a rigid 4-4-2 team, and that's unusual now. And obviously physically very strong and athletic. So it's a completely different situation to play in Armenia, for example.
And what about the windows away from those very intense?
The windows
periods?
Away, yes. Yeah. I've been obviously Toulon was 3 weeks altogether because we'd 5 matches in that tournament, and then the week before preparing for it in camp, and then I went to Italy for the under 21 European Championships, which was a great learning curve for me as well, to see that full houses and these obviously to go and watch all these games, Spain, Italy, Germany, Austria, great games, seeing Romania twice against Romania in England and in Cesena, great games at under 21 level. For example, England had in midfield Mason Mount, Ben Foden, James Morrison, and attackers like did an option of sort of Tammy Abraham, Calvert-Lewin or Solanke, and to pick one of those, so that'll give you the indication. But they were nowhere near it. They weren't in contention. You had really strong Spain, strong Italy. Italy were excellent, actually, in the tournament, and unlucky overall. So it's a good tournament. I went to Armenia for the under-19 European Championships to witness that. Obviously, Tom Owens' team did brilliantly on that, and it was great to just to witness the tournament and see the standard and look at the different styles and so forth. I think obviously I've had an opportunity to sit down with one or two people who've managed international teams and to see what their best international practice is.
And who were they, Stephen?
And also, but I think for me, it's been a busy period doing Toulon, Italy, Armenia, and then the 12 games in between. Probably now between September and March, or between November and March, I get an opportunity to go and visit clubs more, maybe, right, and have a look at the intensity of their training and what they're doing. Because you obviously have to update yourself all the time. It's continuous learning, really.
Yeah.
And I think you have to. And so that gives me, that sort of, I've blocked out my calendar year. So between November and March, that gives me great opportunity to go and do that, to travel to different clubs around Europe and go and do that.
Very good. And who were the coaches you sat down with?
Well, I've sat down with a couple, but I don't want to say too much in that. But obviously, Roberto Martinez is very good with his time, you know, and very helpful, I must say. You know, very good insight into sort of the Belgian camp, how they prepare, what they do, that training week, how they prepare, how they liaise with clubs, how they do all of that. You know, it's very, very, very interesting.
Yeah. Have you, because I'm sure you keep an eye vaguely on what's going on in the media, and as you will find out, I suspect, and as you're aware, it's a tough role in the senior position, and there's lots of scrutiny, and there's, you know, you could have done this, you could have done that. And certainly over the course of the current campaign, there has definitely been, I think, an expectation that when you come in, you'll play a completely different brand of football and you're going to be like a saviour of sorts. Have you noticed that kind of growing pressure and sense of expectation about your role? Because it's certainly there.
No, I haven't really. I think I've been just focusing on doing the job to the best of my ability. And I think great staff, like, you know, I think Keith Andrews is an absolutely brilliant, Jim Crawford, people behind the scenes, really, really good. I think just focusing, like, you know, just all the time. International football is so fickle, even at any level. Like, could have lost, could have come out with 2 points or 1 point from the two games, and the group looks a lot different, you know. So getting 6 points from that window is massive for us, and that was huge. And it's great for the players because they have their own dreams and they all have their aspirations and different levels. Obviously, say someone like Troy Parrott, you know, who's got a tremendous attitude, really has, but, you know, he's accelerating, obviously moved to the first team quickly. Some players might be looking at trying to get to the first team quickly. But for other players, obviously the opportunity to play in the under-21 European Championships is a huge deal, and Ireland have never done it. So I've never competed at that. So I think, you know, they're trying to qualify, be the first team to qualify, and there's already been great games against top teams this year, and they've really benefited from that. They want more of the same, would really, really improve their international experience and make them more ready for the senior international team as well.
Yeah.
So I think that's so different players would have, you know, would be fast tracked quicker than others.
And what are we looking at here in Parrott? Because it seems he really is exceptional. And another goal last night, people would have seen his performance away to Sweden. He's training with obviously a very, very talented Spurs team. Without heaping pressure on him, what are we looking at here in Troy Parrott, do you think, Stephen?
Yeah, it's too early to say. I think, to be fair to him, I think what I will say, he's an exceptionally young man. He's great, a great attitude. And that was never more evident last night. Because really, he's only really played 4 games for me, right, at the under-21 level. So he's played 3, or he's played 4. One of them, we left him out because we played Armenia. We're travelling to Sweden quickly. We made 3 or 4 changes. And he came on after half time and scored twice in Sweden. And so I was working it out today. In the four game, he gets sent off against Italy, obviously, very unfortunately, in an altercation with Moise Keane. That was nothing, really. It was nothing he sent off. So he's only really played 390 minutes overall, if you take his minutes into account, slightly over 390 minutes, and he scored 4 goals. And we haven't played him as a number 9 yet. So I think that's not a bad return for 17-year-old under-21 level, you know?
No.
And I think the thing about it is the two incidents that were good, where I suppose that were impressive, were one, he scored the winner on his debut against Armenia at home 1-0. We went with 3 midfield players in Sweden, 3, you know, Orthodox midfield players, and we played a little bit differently. And more possession-based, definitely trying to control that away from home. And he just played and that, and he just came in. So we left him out of that, but he reacted by coming off the bench when we were losing and scored two brilliant goals to win 3-1. And then last night we're losing 1-0. He's playing in the number 10 position. You know, we've got to make tactical changes at half time, and we've asked him to do another job, to play on the left, but not to play on the left, to come in off the left and supplement the midfield and overload and get forward and get strikes on goal from that position. And he equally done that. The Swedish right back Bejmo, who's sort of quite a raider and a good player for them, gets forward. Even Troy was willing to get back after him all the way and chase him down. So he's shown very good values as a young player. He's not like coming, you know, he's shown brilliant values, but he hasn't played any league games, and it's early days for him, and still 17. And,
yeah,
you know, so he's shown very good values as a young man. And I think that's, he has respect of his teammates because he works so hard. And I think those are great attributes.
Well, we'll have to see how Jose treats him now. Hasn't been renowned in the years for giving young players their chance, but we'll see. I mean, he may not have huge money to spend at Spurs, and it'd be great to see Parrott progress. How many of, you know, the under 21 batch that you're working with, and you know, you would know how tough it is for these guys to make it and make careers for themselves. How many have a really good chance of making a living at Premier League or Championship level?
Right, that's an interesting question. You know, I'd say quite a few have, you know, for sure. Yeah, you know, I wouldn't be pessimistic about that. We've seen sort of obviously Queevan Kelleher. It's difficult for young goalkeepers. Queevan's come in, done well in the Carabao Cup. He's been injured, so that's opened the door for Gavin Bazunu. And Gavin's only 17, so. Gavin has done really well at Manchester City as a 17-year-old after coming up from Shamrock Rovers. So you go right throughout the team, really, and there's players like Nathan Collins has been involved with Stoke, and he's only 18. Jason Knight has been involved with Derby. He's only 18. So Jason Malumbi's been on loan at Millwall from Brighton, doing well, and obviously Aaron Conley was up right and came in, and Troy Parrott in the Carabao Cup for Tottenham.
Sure.
So there's been players throughout. Gavin Kilkenny said a bit of play in the Carabao Cup for Bournemouth. There's been players, I'm probably overlooking a few of the players.
Sure.
Also. Adam Oida, you know, has been on the bench for Norwich. Mm. He's still only 18. Obviously came from College Corinthians in Cork. You know, terrific attributes as a player, Adam. Very quick and physically strong, and you just developing as a person, as a player.
Mm.
And the goal last night would have done the world of good. So
Yeah. There's
a lot of talent there, but it's not always the one that shines at 17 and 18. You know, I think a lot can happen in your career.
Mm.
You know, I think the ones that have the best attitude have a great chance, you know. So it's important. Attitude is very important. The level of professionalism. And very professional group, you would find that's one of the things. They're all very conscious of the modern young players. They're all very conscious of their body and their nutrition and their you know, their strength and conditioning. And these are all critical things in their development and the prevention of it for injuries, of course, which is huge.
Yeah. You're in a position now where what you say will be garnered that bit more attention. You're in the back pages over the comments about the flights to Armenia. So it's a taster of things to come as well. Was it right to take 3 different flights to get to Armenia? Could something not more have been done there? What was the reason for that?
Realistically, when you're on the 21 manager, you know, you're not in a position within the FEI to be flying directly to Armenia because, you know, chartering a flight costs, would blow your budget out of the water really for the year if you were doing that. So I wouldn't complain about that. These are things that you just have to access. We have to go London, Kiev, Yerevan, and come back to Moscow and back to Dublin, Yerevan, Moscow, Dublin. But these are things that are not unsurmountable, and they're not, because we got 6 points, and my complaint was never about that.
Right.
I never complained about that, because I just made the point that it would be a tough window because the players have to contend with it, and we just have to prepare for it. But I certainly wasn't complaining about that, because that's when you're under 21 managers, you understand that's the gig. Mm. And you have to be realistic, and you can't be, you know, chartering flights to Armenia, which is 4 hours the other side of Moscow. Mm. Because the costs are huge. And I think that's part of the you know, you've got to just manage accordingly. Different yes. for the senior international team, of course.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
You understand that.
Ah, look, you'll be first class then, don't worry. I almost completely forgot to put it to you, because looking at you in the sideline last night, you're full of vigour and all smiles and up and down and physical and looking rude health. You had a bit of a health scare after, I think it was the Swedish game, or you're back now, you're feeling good?
I'm feeling great. I'm feeling great, actually. It wasn't the worst place to fall ill in Sweden. You know, they've got the best health service, and one of the best health services in the world. Brilliant. I was looked after brilliantly. So I had a week there, obviously, after everyone else had gone home. I had an extra week there in hospital, but I'm absolutely fine now and enjoying the work, you know.
Good. Okay, good to hear. So last question. This is a very exciting time for you. Are you in the mode of enjoying the 21s, but counting down the days until you get started as senior manager? Does it feel close? Does it feel far away? Is it something, I presume, that's crossing your mind most days? What's your general attitude to the kind of clock counting down?
I'm trying to just focus bit by bit, and certainly that was the last night. Was, you know, the getting the 6 points from that window was a huge window for us, because we were disappointed to. The players have been brilliant, dominated all the games. So how we lost on Iceland, I'll never know.
Yeah.
Because that struck in the craw, really. I was really hugely disappointed by that, because we never deserved to lose that game. I think to get the 6 points there was brilliant last night. And yeah, we've got to continually prepare myself, obviously, going forward. That's, you know, I'm well aware of that. And, you know, I'm as I spoke about earlier, I'm taking measures to do that. But I think for me now, we've got two games in March. We've got Iceland at home, which is, Iceland are doing well in the group also. They've already sort of got their Italy away and Sweden away fixtures finished. And so the home record is good. It's a tough place to go, so they're still in the picture. So our next game against Iceland in March will be an important game, and if we can beat Iceland at home and Luxembourg, it means we can win the group, you know, in the last game against Italy, or try and win the, you know, prepare to go to Italy with a view to either being guaranteed a playoff or winning the group. So that's where we are, and that's the motivation for March.
Okay. Well, listen, brilliant performance last night. Fantastic win, 4-1 against Sweden. Stephen, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Joe. Thank you.
With your blinker eyes.